and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're learning more about Islam from some of our fellow residents here in Anchorage. We'll hear from a panel of three people as they answer questions and discuss the teachings of Islam about peaceful living. This event took place on January 20th of 2017 at the Hilton Hotel and was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Lisa Falsko, President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, moderates the discussion and starts things off.
We are so happy to see everyone here. We are a membership organization. If you are currently a member of the World Affairs Council, do you mind raising your hand? Do we have some members? Fabulous. Thank you so much for supporting the World Affairs Council and what you do. And tell those people next to you who didn't raise their hand to join the World Affairs Council, because we are gearing up for a great season once again. We've been doing this for over 50 years, longer than Alaska has been a state, and we're really proud of being able to bring programs that are unfiltered, nonpartisan, non-political. We don't take a stance on a specific topic, but we bring in different ideas and topics and discussions, and with that, we believe that that creates better democracy and better citizenry. So we are so happy that the members are here, and I encourage everyone else to join the Alaska World Affairs Council. So we'll just go ahead with the program. Today, as all of you know, is a momentous day with a changeover of U.S. Leadership, and there's a lot of questions surrounding that with Muslim countries and people. And a lot of us, we here, haven't had the opportunity to have discussions. Ah, Ben, come on up. Just come and join us. Perfect timing. Perfect. Haven't had the opportunity to meet different people of different faiths and religions and have a conversation. And so we're going to do that today with three different perspectives on this topic. And then I'm going to try to make it kind of quick, pose some hot topic questions to just get them out of the way, and then open it up for questions from the audience. So we'll have a lot of time left over here for your questions. So please thinking of those as we go. We really want to hear from all of you and your questions. So our panelist to my immediate left here is Mr. Ben Jones, also known as Shaban Jones. He is a third-generation African-American Muslim, originally from South Carolina. In 2013, Jones moved to Alaska for more opportunities. He is currently working towards his bachelor's in education. Jones follows the Sufi doctrine, which is the spirit of Islam, and believes that mankind is the family of God. He is a member of a group called United Muslim Christian Forum, which is dedicated to promoting peace and love between the two faiths and removing misunderstandings. To his right, we have Mr. Sajid Raza, who is a graduate student in transportation engineering at UAA. Raza is from Pakistan and a representative of the International Students Club. He is also working as a graduate research assistant on different research projects at UAA, as Sajid is a Sunni Muslim. To his right, we have Ms. Heather Barber, who is an attorney in Anchorage and is a member and representative of the Islamic Community Center of Anchorage, Alaska, the largest Muslim community in Alaska. Heather was raised as a Christian, but began a serious study of Islam following 9/11 with a scholar in California while in law school. She converted to Islam in 2004. Heather came to Alaska in 2007 and became involved with the ICCAA, where she later met her husband. Heather is a Sunni Muslim and is involved with interfaith dialogue, outreach, and education. Please give them a warm round of welcome. So let's start with some information about Islam and what it means to you. So Islam is the second largest religion and the fastest growing in the world. Between 1.5 and 1.8 billion followers around the world, with the largest concentration in Indonesia, followed by Bangladesh, and Pakistan, and the war zones that we consider to be the large hotspot of Muslims, Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan, don't even make the top 10 lists. And so I want to hear from our panelists. Tell us something about Islam that people here might not know, and what Islam means to you. And Ben, I'll give you the hot seat since you're right next to me.
Hello.
I pray everyone is well today. I'm very honored to be given the opportunity to speak about Islam today. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting us. I would keep it very, very brief. I know we have a lot to speak about today. I'm going to read a few of the excerpts from the final sermon of Prophet Muhammad, which is one of the most important documents in Islam, in which he spoke in his last year of life to an audience of over 100,000 people. Like I said, I'll keep it very, very brief. I'm not going to read the whole thing because time does not allow. So he said, O people, just as you regard this month, this day, this city as sacred, so regard the life and property of every Muslim as a sacred trust. Hurt no one so that no one may hurt you. This is very, very important hurt no one so that no one may hurt you. O people, it is true that you have certain rights with regard to your women, but they also have rights over you. Remember that you have taken them as your wives only under a trust from God and with his permission. If they abide by your rights, then to them belongs the right to be taken care of. Do treat your women well. It's very, very important because some of the topics today we'll be speaking about women in Islam. So the Prophet instructed us, do treat your women well and be kind to them, for they are your partners. O people, listen to me in earnest. Worship God, perform your five daily prayers, fast during the month of Ramadan, and offer zakat. Perform Hajj if you have the means. This is what makes us Muslim. This is the five pillars of Islam. An Arab has no superiority over a non-Arab, nor does a non-Arab have any superiority over an Arab. A white person has no superiority over a black person, nor does a black person have any superiority over a white person. No one has superiority over another except by piety and good actions. So be aware, do not stray from the path of righteousness after I am gone. O people, no prophet or apostle will come after me, and no new faith will be born. Reason well, therefore, O people, and understand the words which I convey to you. I leave behind me two things, the Holy Quran and my example, the Sunnah. And if you follow these, you will never go astray. Now, for me, Islam is a manual of how to live a pure, healthy, well-balanced, simple, but fruitful life. Now I'll let Sajid.
Sajid, same question. Tell us something about Islam that people here might not know, and what Islam means to you.
Hello. Thanks to all of you for today. Today I am here to talk about Islam and peace. Let's start our conversation with the fact that the word Islam has the same root as the word salam, which means peace, secured, making peace, being in a mutual, peaceful environment, etc. The greeting, Assalamu alaikum, favored by Muslims, has the literal meaning, peace be upon you. Also, we complete our prayers with the announcement of peace, once to the right and once to the left. Peace is a natural state which attracts each and every individual. It is a condition that everyone is looking for. Islam prohibits violence and promotes peace and justice. According to the Holy Quran, he who kills an innocent soul will be as if he had killed all humankind. And he who saves a life will be as if he had saved the lives of all human mankind. Also, the Prophet, peace be upon him, explained Islam's potential to contribute to safety and peace in society. He specified one goal in his time as the following. A rider will travel from Sin'a, a city in Yemen, to Hadramaut, a region in southwest of Arabian Peninsula, fearing none but God. The Prophet commanded us to maintain social solidarity and cooperation, to open our hearts to our fellows, and to help one another at all times. He said, do not cut relations between each other, do not turn your back on each other, and do not grow hatred between each other. O God's servants, become brothers and sisters. The Islam teaches the Muslim that peace is achieved through tolerance and forgiveness. The Holy Quran calls the Muslim the people of the middle path. It says there is no compulsion in religion. The Quran calls for coexisting with other religions in the verse which says, to you your religion and to me mine. The Quran clearly tells Muslim to protect the places of worships of all other people as much as they defend their mosques. This is clear evidence of the emphasis that Islam has laid on tolerance and coexistence with other religions and civilizations. Islam also gives a distinct system of human law which relates to the dealings of Muslim with the whole world. In this regard, the Quran says the believers are brothers to each other. Therefore, make peace between your two brothers and fear Allah, so that you may gain mercy. A Western scholar, Mr. James Meichner, said, more than most religions, Islam preaches the brotherhood of all races, colors, and nations within its fold. Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself probably had the same skin color as Jesus. But today his followers embrace all colors, black men from Africa, yellow men from China, brown men from Malaya, and white men from Turkey. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, was described as mercy of the two worlds. The victory of Mecca is a unique example in human history of a non-violent, bloodless, peaceful conquest that had no casualties, no collateral damage, and no fallout, except one of creating a universal example of forgiveness and returning evil with good for the world to follow. Making peace is highly encouraged in Islam as in the following verse. And if they incline towards peace, you too lean towards it. And trust Allah, indeed He only is the all-hearing, the all-knowing. The Quran or Islam emphasizes peace and reconciliation as basic to all social and even international relations. As mentioned in the Quran, paradise, which is the reward for the pious, is a place of serenity. Also, one of the 99 names of God is Salam, which means peace. Thank you.
Heather. Hi, good afternoon. Well, since the topic that we were given today is Islam and peace, I'd like to briefly talk about the picture of Islam as a bloody, violent religion, which, as a Muslim myself, I feel is a highly distorted and misguided idea that's held by the general public. I'd like to attempt to disconnect this ugly picture from what appears to be Islam from what really is Islam, or at least what Islam is to me. If Islam is actually a religion of peace, it begs the question, why do we see such violence by Muslims today? Now, the suicide bombings, the hijackings, the killings of innocent civilians, these things are not endorsed by the Quran. In fact, they're violations of it. Well, it hasn't actually always been this way. This is something relatively new. During the 20th century, there has been a militant form of religion called fundamentalism, which has flared up in every major religion as a reaction against modernity and the rise of secularism. Every fundamentalist movement in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is convinced that liberal secular society is determined to wipe it out. They feel threatened, and they believe that they're fighting a defensive battle. And so often, they feel justified in ignoring the more compassionate principles of the faith. But by amplifying the more aggressive passages, they actually distort the tradition. So I imagine you're all thinking, okay, there's a fundamentalist movement in all three religions, but why is it mostly Muslims that we see engaging in violence? And I think to answer that, we need to enter the Twilight Zone, an alternate universe of sight and sound, a universe in which it was not Christian Europe that colonized practically the entire world. You turn on the radio, it's Arabic music. You turn on the TV or go to the movies, you're looking at Middle Eastern programming. Instead of jeans and a t-shirt, you're wearing a dishdasha or an abaya. The Middle Eastern culture is glorified everywhere, and American culture has become something shameful and primitive. Your kids want to move to the Middle East and become Middle Eastern. They're ashamed to be American. They've been indoctrinated by the ubiquitous message that the Middle East is good and America is bad, that the Middle East is the future and America is yesterday's glory. So then imagine we managed to gain our independence, maybe through an extremely bloody civil war. France killed 1.5 million people in Algeria alone during their struggle for independence. But even as a free country, we don't get to set up our own government. Our colonizers set it up for us. They set up a puppet regime that will serve their purposes. They put an ethnic or a religious minority in charge of the majority. This government is oppressive and it's brutal, but the people have no recourse. The regime is being supported by strong countries in the Middle East who will protect it as long as it's serving their purposes. They keep military bases on American soil to keep the peace. You go to church, but since the regime views religious people as a threat, since they're obviously not God-fearing people, there are government agents recording the names of everybody who attends. Life may become very difficult for these people, and they may be labeled as enemies of the state. They may be arrested in the middle of the night with no charges, and they're never heard from again. Suddenly, someone appears on the scene who is going to save us from all of this. They say they're going to establish a state that we can be proud of, but we still struggle to define ourselves in a world where it's been discouraged for so long. Many of our religious leaders are sidetracked. They're caught up in politics and pushing an agenda. They still see the us versus them struggle, and sometimes religion takes a back seat until we defeat them and we shake off this yoke. For them, the ends justify the means. So, if the roles were reversed, would we see a rise in fundamentalist Christian terrorism against the dominant oppressive Middle East? Would one Christian sect turn on the other denominations and assert itself as the real Christianity? And would they start killing members of the other sects? Who knows? Historically, when Christians and other religions have seen themselves threatened and on the defensive, like for example in the Holy Land in the 12th century, in Spain in the 15th century, and Northern Ireland last century, we've seen church-sponsored violence, such as the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, and the Northern Ireland conflict. And I want to pause here because I'm afraid you might think that I'm actually justifying violence or terrorism, that I'm saying that it's reasonable for Muslims to behave violently because of their situation, but actually just the opposite. I'm simply explaining why it is what it is. Islam is a way of life, and even in the most extreme situations, we need to remain faithful to its teachings. We should have the patience to stay strong and not give in to our human nature and tendencies to lash out. We're told how to deal with oppression and injustice through the Quran and the examples of the Prophet, and it is not by harming innocent people. So you really can't take the reality of what we see today in a vacuum to say that Islam is a violent religion, period. We see violence around the world, and it's not just limited to the Muslim parts. Each place, though, where we see rise of groups such as ISIS, there are some common factors. Where did ISIS originate? It didn't originate in places like Morocco or Indonesia, places where there's stability. It originated in Syria and Iraq, places of societal, governmental, and economic chaos. The Taliban was created in a war-devastated Afghanistan. So where you find these factors of great instability and lawlessness, you find the rise of violence. Religion is irrelevant. You can look at sub-Saharan Africa, For example, Uganda is a Christian state, but it suffered the same results. There are Christian terrorist organizations, such as the Lord's Resistance Army, and they do terrible things, but do they represent true Christianity? Yeah, of course not. But in order to gain power, these gangs, they need to hide behind religion, because if they call on something like nationalism to unite people, the targeted audience is really only limited to maybe millions of people. If they claim to be representing a particular religion, they can actually address billions of people. So this leads us to a final and another difficult question. Why do some people overseas celebrate and cheer when something bad happens to the United States, like on 9/11? Again, it's against Islam for anyone to wish harm on others. And I would maybe explain this by comparing it with the story of Robin Hood. You know, there's the bully and there's the little guy who stands up to him. In Robin Hood, he stole from the rich and he gave to the poor, and he was the hero. Everybody loved him. But we might forget, he stole from the rich and gave the poor the money that he didn't have any right to. So he was actually kind of a hero villain. But I mean, don't we all celebrate it when the bully gets its comeuppance? It's vigilante justice, and it's wrong, but sometimes it's really satisfying. So I hope this has cleared up some ideas and helped you understand that why what we see in the media today is not representative of Islam, that Islam is really a religion of peace, and the situation is much more complicated than I can explain in a couple minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really want to get to questions from the audience. Before we do that, I want to throw out two hot button topics and just address those now, if you don't mind. And the first one is jihad, and the second one is the women. So maybe we can start with you, Heather, and just come back down the line. My understanding is that jihad does not mean holy war, and it means us to struggle, to strive, and to strive to surrender to God. Maybe you can explain to us, what does jihad mean?
Jihad, I'm going to actually say that everybody needs to engage in jihad, regardless of religion. Jihad is a struggle to do good outside your comfort zone. It's a struggle against the lower self, against our animal instincts, I guess. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Christians call it the struggle of the flesh. It's a struggle against sin. It's more than just doing good deeds. It's doing them outside your comfort zone. So an example I would give of performing jihad, if you have a lot of money, a lot of food, you cook a huge dinner, and you know that your neighbor is starving, and you bring them food, you've got all this left over, you bring him some, that's a good deed, but it's not jihad. Jihad would be if you have barely enough to feed your own family and you don't know where your next meal is coming from and you still give your neighbor food. That's jihad. You're outside of your comfort zone. Another example that we saw in Europe over the past couple years when they started taking in the refugees. At first, you know, the first wave of refugees came in, there were people welcoming them at the train station, and they were so happy to be bringing these people into the country until it got to be a bit too much. You know, the first couple hundred, couple thousand, when it got up into the millions, suddenly you saw this rise of nationalism, this calls to close the borders. This was a moment of jihad where these countries were outside their comfort zone. They were stretching their own resources, and the countries that continued taking in more refugees, they were really succeeding at jihad. Now, in relation to war, so you can see, obviously, you can have jihad without war, but you can't have a moral war without jihad. So basically, the jihad in war is struggling to maintain your moral compass. We've seen examples where soldiers have run amok, you know, even something as big as committing genocide or rape or, you know, killing innocent civilians. This is the jihad to maintain a moral war, to basically to not violate the international laws. One example, I guess, back in the day, there was a man, his name was Ali, and he was a soldier. He was fighting to protect the Islamic State, and he was fighting a man who was fighting Muslims, fighting Islam. He hated Islam. And Ali was winning. He was just about to take the final death blow. And in an act of defiance, this man spit in his face. And he lowered his sword. Ali lowered his sword. And the man was really kind of confused. He said, "You were just about to kill me. Why did you do this?" And he said, "I have to struggle to maintain my morals. I am fighting on behalf of God because you are trying to kill the Muslims. When you spit in my face, I became angry, and then it became personal. I wanted to kill you for my own revenge. And so because my intention became clouded, I'm no longer going to kill you." That is an example of what jihad during war is. So,
if you'd like to pass the microphone, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, I want to tell you the meaning of jihad. Jihad is an Arabic word often interpreted or translated as a holy war by some people, but in real and purely linguistic sense, the word jihad means struggling or striving. The Arabic word for a war is al-harb, not a jihad. In a religious sense, as described by the Holy Quran and teachings of the Holy Prophet, jihad has many meanings. Number one is jihad against one's own souls. That is, the struggle is against our own temptations, such as greed, lust, and other worldly temptations. The Prophet stated the following: the greatest jihad is the one against your soul. He also said, your greatest enemy is your soul, which is inside you. Jihad against Satan, jihad against injustice, but it is not the war. And the armed jihad against the enemy who attacks your country. This is the jihad of a defensive battle. The Quran has clearly restricted this type of jihad to certain conditions while forbidding transgression of any sort. The battle can only be defensive and not an offensive one. Hence, it is clear that the purpose of any such battle is still to restore peace and not to promote aggressions. It is important to note that starting of such battle is not in the hands of Muslims, but can only be initiated by oppressor fulfilling the aforementioned conditions. The Muslims are only permitted to fight in self-defense if they are being attacked. It is an act of self-defense and not an act of aggressions. If the aggressor ceases to fight, then Muslims are obliged to stop as well for the sake of peace. In the Holy Quran, it is said that if they incline towards peace, incline though also towards it, and put the trust in Allah, surely it is He who is all-hearing, all-knowing. So jihad is not a war. Jihad is like fighting against your own temptations, your own greeds, etc. Thank you.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from a panel of three Anchorage residents as they answer questions about the teachings of Islam and what it means to them. This conversation was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council at the Hilton Hotel on January 20th and was moderated by Lisa Falsko, President and CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, who continues the discussion.
Okay, actually, Ben, could we skip to the next question just out of time, if you want to grab the microphone. You have one. Okay, super. So I'll ask you the next question, and then we'll open it up for questions from the audience. I'm sure people have a lot of things to ask, and that is women. And when I see in the media things like confinement of women to their homes, forced marriages, honor killings, it makes me cringe. So could you tell me what is the view of women in Islam?
Okay. I will try my level best to explain Islamic's view on women. Unfortunately, these topics that we're discussing, people have written books and books on them. So the amount of time we have here, it's not possible for us to fully explain, but we will try to at least touch the tip of the iceberg. So Islam holds women in a very high esteem, and Islam gave life and rights to women 1,400 years ago, when they were being buried alive in Arabia just for being born girls, and when women had no rights of inheritance. Islam does not condone honor killings, the confinement of women to their homes, or forced marriages. And the biggest proof of that is that those types of atrocities are not happening in any of the Western countries where Muslims live, or by anybody whose heart has been truly affected by the light of Islam and is practicing true Islam. There are millions of Muslims living here in America, and none of those things are happening. There are 1.7 billion Muslims worldwide and growing. And if the religion stood for some irrational, illogical idea like oppression towards women, then we would not have 20,000 Americans becoming Muslim every year, more women than men, as reported by NBC News in 2011. There are many sayings of the Prophet regarding women. I would just quote a few here. One saying of the Prophet is, "Paradise lies at the feet of your mother. By this, Islam commands one to honor and serve their mother if they want to go to heaven." Another is, the Prophet has said, "Among the Muslims, the most perfect as regard to his faith is the one whose character is excellent, and the best amongst you is the one who treats their wives or his wife the best." So again, we do not have that much time, so I'm not going to keep going on and on and on. I will let...
Actually, we'll open it up for the floor. If you have questions, please raise your hand. If you could wait for the microphone, this is being recorded for the radio.
Hi, my name is Camilla Hussein. I grew up in Syria. I'm a grad student here at UAA. I had a question about, you know, you're reciting parts of Islam and or part of the scripture and the hadith and everything. And yes, it is in on paper, it is a very peaceful religion. I think it's the applicability of Islam, as such as any other religion. It's the people who make that religion. And I think, so my question is, I don't know if it's even a question. I think it's more a statement. I think what we see, I grew up in Syria, so Alawites, my family are Alawites in Syria. If you know what that is, it's an offshoot of Shia. And they suffered terribly throughout the centuries. I think there has to be a dialogue between people who represent Islam and I don't know what you uttered. It's just too literal on paper. I think there should be a better way to explain Islam than just reading off scriptures. I think we need to have more data, more involvement with the community. I think that's all.
Okay, so would someone suggest a better way for folks to understand Islam? Anyone?
Go meet a Muslim. Come, no, you, yes, you are different. But for everybody else, dialogue is the only way. We need to build bridges, and we can't do that unless we understand each other. So I understand the Alawites. The Alawites, that's Bashar al-Assad's, his sect, and so Syria is... If we had a week, we couldn't explain it. But for anybody out here, if you want to know anything about Islam, if you want to know what people really believe, the ICCA, we are used to having visitors. We welcome you. you are, you know, just come, introduce yourself, say, I've got questions about Islam, you know, I've got conflicting information, I want to find out more. Just get to know us, you know. If we get your phone number, you could, or your email address, you can get on our mailing list. We can invite you to potlucks. You know, it's we're very much into an interfaith dialogue at the ICCA. I don't know if any of you remember, about 10 years ago, there was a program called Engaging Muslims here in Anchorage. It was put on by APU. And part of it, there was a small group of us who just went by invitation to church upon church, to synagogue, to temple, and just gave an Islam 101 class. This is what it is, this is what it isn't. And we got connections, you know. We became very close with, say, the rabbi at Temple Beth Shalom. Just wonderful people there. Many of the churches, we've become good friends with the pastors and the communities there. And that is the way that we're going to unite in this country. You know, when we realize that our differences are just in the details, really. Judaism and Christianity and Islam, especially, the similarities far outweigh our differences. And if we just look at where the differences are and just agree to respectfully disagree, we can just build from there. And I accept just about every invitation I get to speak. And because I do believe that it's very important to get out there and get our faces seen, and just to make people comfortable that we're not this boogeyman that's waiting for you. You know, we're just people. We're just like you. And I think if we can make those friendships and build those bridges, you know, our future is limitless.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question.
Thank you. Ms. Barbour, speaking of getting to know each other better, could you tell us a little bit about your personal journey and your decision to embrace Islam, and perhaps what you found in the religion that you had not found in Christianity?
Sure, I'm happy to. I know time is a factor, so I'll keep it brief. Basically, my journey in earnest began after 9/11, because I had known some Muslims beforehand, and they were wonderful people. And suddenly, when I saw this, you know, the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, I was just amazed. I couldn't believe what kind of horrible religion would make somebody do something like that. And so I ended up, I was just 3 weeks into my first semester of law school. And so on campus, I looked up the Muslim Student Association, and I just said, you know, I just want to sit and talk, and I want to learn some more. We started with a weekly study with a scholar in the Bay Area. And for me, I was happy with my own religion. I thought I had all the answers, and it was just curiosity. I just wanted to learn about another religion, another culture, one that I foresaw becoming very important in this country. And as time went on, I just really saw the beauty in it. I saw that not only was it not the religion that we saw in 9/11, it was the complete opposite, and that Muslims were just as horrified as non-Muslims were. And just, you know, the more I studied, the more I talked, the more I learned, I just, what began just out of curiosity, I realized it was for me, I believed it was the right path, that it was the path that is going to give me a good, moral, fulfilling life, and hopefully, inshallah, will prepare me for the next life as well.
Thank you very much. And do we have another question? Right back there. Yes.
What is your hope that someday there could be peace between the Sunni and the Shia movements within Islam? Is there an ecumenical movement that is taking place to try to make peace.
It's a very good question. Yes, we do believe that peace is coming, and it's coming very soon. And not only between the Shia and the Sunni, but between all those who truly love God. As I'm not sure if I said it earlier, but I'm a part of a group called United Muslim Christian Forum, where it's not United Muslim. When I say Muslim, as I quote in the beginning, the final sermon of Prophet Muhammad, he very clearly dealt with a lot of the problems the Muslim world is going through now by saying that all Muslims are the brother to another Muslim. So, as was stated by another panelist, that most of the religions are similar, and particularly in Islam, the difference between Shia and Sunni does not, the five pillars is what brings both together. And that's where the rest, all of the Muslims have to come back to the basics. Praying five times a day, making the Hajj pilgrimage if you can afford, fasting in the month of Ramadan. So these things are what will bring the Muslims back together.
Could I just add something with that? I think that the Sunni-Shia divide is really overblown. It's really, there's not a lot of religious differences. It's mostly, well, how the split originated after the death of the Prophet. There was a disagreement on who should be the next leader, the next caliph. And so it was no disagreements on, yeah, we should pray this way or that way. It was over the succession. And because of that, it's basically a political difference. You know, I would maybe say it's something similar to the Catholic and Protestant division, where it's, that's even more religious than the Sunni-Shia divide. Where you see the conflicts between the two, it's not over religious differences. It's over politics. It's over land or something like that. It's a lot like the conflict in Northern Ireland, where you had the Catholics and the Protestants killing each other, but neither one of them cared about the religion. It had nothing to do with that. And so for people that are not involved in the political scene, it really is not an issue, I think, for most people. Like my family is, my husband's family is Sunni, but my brother-in-law married a Shia, a woman from Saudi Arabia, actually. And when we're all together, it's not even in anybody's mind. You know, that would be like a Protestant family, one of the kids marries a Catholic. It's a non-issue, you know? So, I think it gets a lot of headlines, but I don't think that is the problem that it is portrayed.
Thank you. Next question.
Hi, I'm Jody. I work with an organization that provides education in Pakistan. So I'm really heartened to see this many people curious to learn more. I think it's really important. I've found it very curious that Malala, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, is not celebrated by more of her fellow Muslims for speaking out on behalf of girls' rights to education. And I don't know if any of you might be able to speak to that, nor whether it's a Muslim-Islam issue, but I'd be very interested in learning to hear what you might think.
Sajid, do you have some comments on that, being from Pakistan?
Hello. Yeah, Malala incident occurred in Pakistan, I think in 2009 or something. But some like non-educated people say that it is a drama of Western world or something. But she was like supporting the educations of girls and everything. And it occurred in Pakistan.
Heather, did you want to add something to that?
Well, I want to add that I think she's great. And I think a lot of Muslims do, especially women. But the only criticisms that I've heard, just kind of like sour grapes, like she's a sellout, you know, that she's on a publicity tour. It's kind of ridiculous, but that would be the only reason why some people wouldn't support her.
Okay, but, next question.
So I appreciate the reinterpretation of the word jihad, and I'm sure we don't have enough time to talk about all the terms within Islam, but one word that really does interest me are fatwas. Now, the vast majority of fatwas are benign, right? They're edicts about the doctrine of Islam. But there's a minority of fatwas which are used to justify violence, such as when Ayatollah Khamenei called for the assassination of Salman Rushdie. So I was wondering, how do you view those minority of violent fatwas? Do you view them as invalid?
Okay, so could someone explain to all of us what a fatwa is and the minority fatwas and if they're valid?
Okay, a fatwa, I kind of feel like I'm monopolizing the stage a little bit. A fatwa is just a religious ruling, which is actually non-binding. That's key. And to announce a fatwa, a scholar can do it, but it's something that the people who are actually qualified to do it are very hesitant to, because they know, like, say if I'm a great scholar and I say, you know, something like that, for example, that this person needs to be killed. Well, I have to be so careful because that might be a sin in itself if I give a bad fatwa. But then if anybody follows it, that sin is also on me. For example, we had an issue here in Alaska in our community about how to handle Ramadan and praying, especially during the summertime, because, you know, Ramadan, we start fasting before sunrise, and we don't break our fast till after sunset. So, it's been challenging, but, you know, we don't want to just everybody do their own thing. So what we did was we consulted a scholar and asked him, what should we do? And he took the answer. He was a very smart man, very educated. He could have just told us, oh, well, I think you should do this. But no, he did not want that responsibility. So he took it back to the North American Fiqh Council, which you know, takes care of rulings and stuff. And he discussed it with a lot of different scholars. And they gave us a non-binding a fatwa that said, because of the extreme daylights up here, that we should follow Mecca time. So if they fast from 7 to 7, we'll fast from 7 to 7. Doesn't matter what the sun does. So that man, he knew that that was a great responsibility. And so he did not take it lightly. And that's just something that's kind of a detail. But as far as fatwas like Osama bin Laden, he used to give them right and left, fatwa this, fatwa that. He wasn't a scholar even. You know, he was a civil engineer, I think. And he took that responsibility so lightly that I'm really glad I'm not going to be on his shoes on the Day of Judgment, because not only is he responsible for that fatwa, but anybody who followed it, that sin is going to all be on him. So that's my take on it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. I'm Sam Combs. I'm a past president of the World Affairs Council and also of Jewish Heritage, and I'm dismayed at today's inauguration, and I was wondering how you feel.
Oh, you got it. That's right.
Silence.
I actually have not had a chance to see the inauguration yet. But I will be looking at it after the program. Sorry about that.
Anybody else?
Well, I purposely boycotted it, and I left my TV tuned to the cartoon channel so that not only would he not get the ratings, but it would also bring his percentages down.
Sajid, do you have any thoughts on the upcoming election? No. Okay, so next question.
Hello, my name's Brooke. This question is for you. I'm sorry, I can't remember your name. But you talked about your personal journey converting to Islam. I just want to know, I know what drew you to Islam was a morality, living a moral life and having those guidelines to live by, and just living a fulfilling life. What separates Islam from the other religions? If you can be an atheist and live a moral life, what makes Islam different for you in your eyes?
Okay, that's a long question. Do you have a short answer to that by chance?
Yeah, I do have a tendency to go on. I would say, yeah, you do not need religion to be a good person. That's absolutely true. Although I think you do need to have a faith to really go outside, like to really struggle, like in jihad, like to say to lay down your life for somebody else. That's something kind of beyond the pale. And for me, I really see it as a preparation for the afterlife as well. It just made sense. It's such a small leap between Christianity and Islam. I would say really the only significant difference is the status of Jesus between the two religions, where the Christians believe that he's part of the Trinity, that he is the Son of God, and in Islam is strictly monotheistic. There are no partners. Jesus was a great prophet. We follow his teaching, we love him, but we do not believe in his divinity. So it's, the morality, everything, it's very similar between the two.
Now, Ben, I understand you also have a story as well with a conversion in your background. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
My grandfather was, he had just joined the military. And he was a Christian at the time. I think it was during the time of the Vietnam War. And before he was deployed, he wanted to go to church. And they told him, oh, you can't go to the white church. You have to go to the black church. So he said, well, I'm about to be deployed with these people. We're about to risk our lives together for our country, but we can't pray together. So he wanted to find a religion that welcomed all. And during that time, here in America, there was, and now there's still a lot of separation, but Islam opened the doors for him. It welcomed people of all denominations. So that's how my grandparents came over to Islam.
Okay, we're running out of time. We could have one more question.
Hopefully this will be a little bit of an easier question, much like how Christians and Catholics can view God as a almost Santa Claus-looking white man sitting above the clouds. How is Allah viewed in Islam?
He has no form. His physical, well, his attributes, he has 99 names, you know, the creator, the sustainer, the merciful, blah, blah, blah. But as far as his physical attributes, it specifically says that no matter what you come up with in your wildest imagination, you're not going to come anything close.
Okay, I want to actually ask one more question. Sorry about that. But I was wondering, what is it like being a Muslim in America, and specifically here in Alaska? And do you get a lot of questions? Are you open to questions? And do people comment on your attire? Just share something about what it's like being a Muslim in Alaska.
Well, I've been in Alaska about 3 years. So I'll try to keep this very brief. It's been a very nice experience. But to tell the truth, it has been difficult just living in America, period, as a Muslim, with all of the stereotyping, all of the misinformation, and as well as because of the extremists who have hijacked the name of Islam and are using this name to commit the most horrendous, despicable, evil deeds, which are totally against Islam. There was one case, I believe in 2015, that I saw on the news, where a man named Robert Daugherty from Tennessee was arrested by the FBI for plotting to kill residents and destroy the schools and mosque of a Muslim village in upstate New York. But despite the difficulties that me as a Muslim I face, my love for God doesn't change, and my peaceful way of life does not change. I mean, we put our trust in God and we try to continue to educate people what Islam truly stands for. The group that I'm a part of, called the United Muslim Christian Forum, was created for this very purpose. We believe that the closest people to us are the people who follow Jesus, Son of Mary, and that together we can make the world a better place.
Sajid.
It's my second year here in Alaska, and for me, the people of Alaska is great and very friendly. I have many friends from all the community, Christians. I visited churches, and I haven't heard any single word against Muslim or Islam from anyone. Simply the people of Alaska is remarkable, and I like this place.
Heather. I would just agree with that Alaska is, it's a different place. I'm much more comfortable here than I would be in a lot of places in the lower 48, especially wearing my hijab. We've gotten very few negative comments. I mean, of course, there's going to be the handful anywhere. But one thing that I have found is people have gone out of their way to tell me, you know, you're welcome here, and if you have any problems, give me a call, because I'm going to stick up for you. And people that are afraid for us, and they want to make sure that we know that we're safe.
Thank you very much. You can join me in a round of applause for our speakers.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been hearing from three Anchorage residents as they discuss Islam and its teachings on peace and everyday life. They were speaking at the Hilton Hotel on January 20th at an event sponsored by the Alaska World Affairs Council. I'm the host and producer of Addressing Alaskans, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.